Oling and wicked regards once again to all who care and dare to listen. This is JLL with another preview of Planetary Tantra. And as usual, you can find the entire talk on that page of Nemeta, and I provide the link below. Just to update you with how I'm progressing in my overhaul of Nemeta, with specific goals to make Planetary Tantra more accessible, you will find that on the landing page linked here, there is a rectangle, and inside that rectangle, which is titled War of Games, are the talks I previewed here on YouTube. And as a matter of fact, you don't even have to go and register as a visitor to access those talks. Because they are on the landing page, you can access, anyone can access them directly. So this procedure accords with my longtime determination to keep Planetary Tantra absolutely free. I am not here to create a cult of Planetary Tantra like the cult of Scientology. And even though I admit that Nemeta is an educational cult, I say that upfront in order to be completely transparent, I mean it in the benevolent sense of the word. So any specific study or practice from bingo to flying drones to flying gliders to rock climbing to anything you can name that appeals to a specific group of people and that requires that you follow certain principles and rules is a cult. So Nemeta is an educational cult, but the material on Planetary Tantra is unique and distinct from all the other content on Nemeta. So as I say, anyone who stumbles upon the page can listen to these talks. So I am not a cult leader recruiting people into Planetary Tantra so that I can brainwash them and change their identities and make a lot of money off them, because I receive absolutely nothing whatsoever for Planetary Tantra, never have and never will. Just wanted to be clear on that. I do accept donations for my other work, which reflects my studies and investigations and experiments through the entire course of my life. So the other courses on Nemeta reflect what I have learned. And in that case, yes, those who choose to donate and have access to all the units on the school are welcome to do so. The other point I want to make is that you might be wondering, you're certainly asking by now, well, John, stop beating around the bush. Tell us exactly and precisely what the practice of Planetary Tantra is. Give us the simple and basic instructions, right? Well, actually, I've already done that, and I've been doing it for years. The situation is, however, that I do require your patience because those instructions are not presented right now in such a way that you can go directly to them and proceed A, B, C to know what the practices are, to know what the goal of those practices are, and to undertake the practices. So I'm getting there. You will have that eventually. But I want to advise you that at the moment, that panel I've created on the landing page for Course 16 Planetary Tantra contains orientation material. It answers questions that arise when you approach Planetary Tantra. And it talks about the background of it as well, the framing concepts, and the metaphors I use, which are primarily three: the metaphor of dreaming, the metaphor of gaming, and the metaphor of movie making, which is called the cinematic metaphor. So what you find there now is not the explicit instructions of how to practice PT, but they are coming, and they're coming soon. So the title of this talk is, "You Are Not a Divine Spark Trapped in Matter." And I'm including this talk in that panel as a tool of orientation. This subject of the divine spark, in quotes, comes up often. And it so happens, well, you know about connotations, don't you? Well, what are the connotations of the word divine spark, just as I pronounce it right now? I have found, and this has been reinforced by people who've written me on this issue, that the term divine spark has certain connotations which some people might equate with the basic teachings of the Gnostics of the ancient mystery schools. I can understand why that would happen. Nevertheless, I do my very best, my level best, as they say, to distinguish the metaphysical theory, or the religious doctrine, you could say, of the divine spark from what you find in planetary tantra, so that you don't bring erroneous and misleading connotations coming from that term into your interest in planetary tantra. In fact, I assure you, you can completely eliminate the term divine spark from your syntax, and you're better off in doing so because it has nothing at all to do with either the theory or practice of planetary tantra. Clear enough? I have to add, for complete clarification, and I've said this before, there are interpretations of Gnosticism that are circulating out there on the internet, and some of them receive hundreds of thousands of views, and some of them come to you in high production documentaries and presentations with certain religious scholars and certain pop gurus, and they are really, really impressive. But in those versions of what the Gnostics taught, you find embedded the concept of the divine spark. And you find that those who are propagating that version of Gnosis, actually talking about Gnosticism, they're not talking about the living Gnosis today because they don't know what it is and they don't practice it. But you find that those who are promoting that version will assume that, yes, Gnostics claimed that we are sparks of divinity trapped in a material nightmare. You will hear this said over and over again. And I've refuted this extensively. But in this talk, I'm going to take a slightly different direction with that refutation. And I'm going to go back to the origins. Where did this concept come from? This concept of the divine spark trapped in matter, assuming that matter is evil, assuming that matter, the material substance of the world, is the product of a satanic demiurge, and assuming that even the material processes of nature are not directed by divine and benevolent forces, but they are directed by the same satanic adversary. You see, that's the scenario that goes along with the commonly held interpretation of divine spark. So let me take you back to the origins of that concept. In order to do so, I make two references. There is the ancient Asian origin, and then there is the more recent origin that comes out of a specific tribal tradition of religious doctrine. So, what is the most ancient Asian origin of this notion? Well, it goes back to the Vedas and the Hindu yogis of the past. And the story says that these wise men dedicated themselves to renouncing the world so that they could go back to the origin of the world. And so the goal of the ancient practices of yoga was to reach God, reach the source, the divine, the absolute, Shiva, the ground of consciousness and being, or to use the full expression in Sanskrit, Sat-Chit Ananda, the ground of being, consciousness, and bliss. And that was the sole and universal goal of yogic practices, right? And presumably some of these yogis, rishis, mahatmas, whatever you want to call them, actually achieved that. They achieved the ultimate realization of God. And what did they have to say about it? Well, they all said the same thing, that God is yourself and yourself is God. So your true identity, stripped of the illusions you have about yourself, shows that yourself is identical with the divine self. So in the syntax of that ancient system, you find the duality, the dichotomy of higher and lower self, which, by the way, you do not find anywhere in the living gnosis today, nor in planetary tantra. I just don't use those terms. Now, here's an example, fairly recently, of the perennial instruction of these Vedic Hindu yogis. It goes to the recognized master, Ramana Maharshi. He lived between 1879 and 1950, and he is indisputably one of the most revered gurus from India. He's from Tamil Nadu, which is southern India, an area I know or used to know quite well. And of course, if he died in 1950, well, he died a decade before the wave of gurus, yogis, and mahatmas hit the Western shores. So of course, in the 60s, you find the Beatles associated with Maharishi Mahesh, and you find various other yogic celebrities such as Sri Chinmoy, Paramahansa Yogananda, who's a little earlier, one of the first, and Muktananda and others. And they were big, big celebrities in the 60s and 70s. But let's take a look at Ramana Maharshi and see what he said, because I would regard him as a faithful representative of that ancient yogic tradition based on the goal of reaching the source, the absolute, the divine. There are many quotes from Ramana Maharshi, by the way. You can easily find them on the internet. And quite a number of these quotes, in my opinion, are pretty saccharine and innocuous. I could well imagine that someone would start a Chinese cookie business, a fortune cookie business, and you could easily put a large number of Maharshi's sayings in fortune cookies. That's the level of intellectual depth and intellectual, what shall I say, substance of these sayings. But here is one particular saying from him. Quote, "The highest goal of man is to inquire, who am I? And realize the self. If a human being does not try to realize this, he lives in vain." End quote. And the self in that quote is capitalized. So there you have it. You could put it in a fortune cookie. And that is the sum and essence of what the ancient rishis and mahatmas and Vedic yogis were attempting to do. Now, whether they did it or not is one thing. I'll give them a credit. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say they did it. They achieved the mystical experience of the ultimate realization of the absolute Parasamvit, Shiva, call it what you will. Okay, I'll give them that. I don't have so much an issue with that. Anyway, how would I confirm it one way or the other, confirm it or deny it? I have an issue with what they said about that supreme mystical experience. So that's what I will talk about in the remaining part of this audio, which you can find on the page linked below. So to continue, the highest goal of man is to inquire, who am I, and realize the self. Well, do you think it would be fair to say, realize the divine spark? I think that's accurate. I don't think that's reading anything into the formula. That isn't there. So the connotation is clear. Divine spark refers to a fragment or fraction of divinity which you hold in your own identity, and you don't even hold it in your own identity. That is your true identity. Yourself, stripped of the illusions of self, is nothing other than the supreme and divine self. This is the message coming from the long tradition of Vedic mysticism. Well, I have an issue with that. And as I say, while I can't confirm or deny if Ramana Maharshi or anyone else actually reached that realization, I have an issue with what they said about it. And I'm reckless and arrogant enough to tell you that, in my view, they made a mistake. They made a mistake in describing what they experienced. And that mistake inheres in all the interpretations, which run into thousands and thousands of texts and coming down to lectures by gurus and allegedly self-realized masters on the internet today who talk about the identity of yourself and the divine self. That vast body of interpretations has a serious glitch in it. So let me use an analogy to describe what that glitch is. Suppose that you are making your way to the kingdom of the Supreme Deity, the Lord of all the worlds, the Lord of creation, the foundation of being, consciousness, and bliss. And you travel through many lands, and finally you come to the great palace where it abides, okay? And you make your way into the palace, and where do you want to go? Well, you want to go to the throne room, because that's where it sits, and you want to be directly in the presence of it, the absolute God, the divine self. And so there you are, you enter the throne room, and there sitting on the throne is the regent, the spiritual regent of the universe, you see? And what is it or he doing in the syntax of Vedic metaphysics? Shiva is he and Shakti is she. So the divine self is often referred to by the masculine gender, right? So what is he, it, doing sitting on the throne? Well, you're in the throne room now. You're right there. You arrived, finally, after all your exertions and exercises, after renouncing normal and ordinary life. Here you are. And now you get a chance to see what the spiritual regent of the universe is doing. It's looking into a mirror. So there is the throne raised up on a platform in this enormous central hall of the palace. And directly across from the throne, like a huge, video screen, like a huge flat plasma screen, at the same level as the regent, is a mirror. And the regent is beholding itself in that mirror. Now, you're standing a little bit back, so you see the regent, say, on your left, enthroned, and you look to the right and you see the mirror. So what happens next? Well, naturally, if you've reached that situation, if you've finally got there, you might just be tempted to step forward a little more and turn to the right and look at yourself in that same mirror. Can you see that? Well, what if you did that? What would you see? Maybe you wouldn't see yourself at all. Maybe the mirror, when you stand in front of it, say with your back to the regent, looking into it in the same way he does, or it does, maybe you wouldn't see the reflection of your body in the mirror. Maybe you would simply see what the regent sees. You would see the reflection of the Supreme Being. And this is described intimately and precisely in a lot of the Sanskrit language that comes down to us from Hindu metaphysics. And this function of mirroring, which is called vimarsha, is often used. The trope of mirroring is continually used to describe what happens at the very highest dimension of the source of reality, the highest and innermost dimension. The trope of mirroring is often used. So you will hear it said that the Lord Shiva beholds himself in a mirror. But what exactly does Shiva see? So let's say you're there in the throne room and you step forward and turn right and you look into the mirror, and right behind you on the throne, Shiva is also looking into the mirror, and he's looking at his reflection in the mirror. But I can guarantee you that if you want to understand what he sees, it requires a deep and careful study of Hindu metaphysics. But let's just say, for the sake of this little parable, that the Supreme Regent sees a reflection of itself. But when you step there in front of the mirror, let's say that you don't see a reflection of your physical body. Your physical body is absent. Let's say you're out of the body, as many of these yogis were when they did these practices. So if you don't see your physical body, what do you see? Well, I submit to you that you see exactly what the regent sees. You see its reflection, and naturally, because your own ordinary lower self is not present in this experience, it's natural that you might identify what you see with what you are. And so that is why the yogis have the tendency to identify their own consciousness with the consciousness of the divine self. How could that happen? Well, it's not difficult to understand. It happened because they identified the reflection in the mirror with their own consciousness. And so they came away with the equation that says yourself is ultimately identical with the divine self. Now, I advise you to note carefully a nuance here. In this paradigm, in this frame that I'm proposing, you don't necessarily have the concept of a fragment, fraction, or spark. In fact, on the contrary, according to the ancient Hindus, your consciousness reflected in the mirror into which the divine self is gazing is identical totally with the consciousness of the divine self. And that is the fundamental teaching of Ramana Maharshi and countless other Asian Mahatmas and gurus. So, in order to get closer to the exact meaning and purpose of this expression, divine spark, the investigation has to go somewhere else. We have to look into another tradition, another legacy, another spiritual or religious doctrine, call it what you will. And what is that? Well, it's the religious doctrine of the Zohar and the Kabbalah, the Kabbalah Dida, and also it refers back in certain ways to the Talmud. So we're looking at the ancient spiritual doctrine or of the ancient Hebrews, which is carried forward in the Zohar and the Kabbalah, which appeared in written form in Spain in the 13th century. You know, Kabbalah means received tradition or received knowledge. And it's somewhat comparable to the Hindu word, Sanskrit word, excuse me, Shruti, which Shruti means revelation. So the ancient Vedic seers had Shruti. They had it visually. They also had it audially in sound. And that was a direct revelation of the divine. So Kabbalah means the received tradition about those who have experienced the direct revelation of the divine. So there's a loose parallel there. So where do you find the initial evidence, and as far as I'm concerned, the crucial evidence about this notion of the divine spark in the Kabbalah? You find it in the model of the tree of life. And the tree, of course, has an upper part, the higher limbs, and then it has a stem or trunk, and then it has a lower part. Anyone can go and look at countless illustrations of the Kabbalistic tree of life, right? Now, Kabbalistic doctrine, particularly associated with Isaac Luria, says that certain entities exist in the lowest sphere of the tree of life. They're down at the bottom. And in certain ways, you could say they're in the trash. Now, it's pretty interesting, I find, to look closely at the description of these entities. Are they entities? What are they? They're variously described as peels, or shards, or husks. But what actually are they? There is a word you need to learn. This is a very weird word. the word by which they are named. You need a name. How does the Kabbalah and the Zohar, how do the Kabbalah and the Zohar name these entities in the lowest dimension of the Tree of Life? This word is spelled in various ways, but generally Q-L-I-P-P-O-T-H. Very weird word. It looks weird. And the pronunciation of it varies. Some say Cliffoth, and some say Cliffoth. Cliffoth. Strange. Cliffoth. Actually, let's take the easier pronunciation, which contains the word cliff. Cliffoth. All right? You'd have to ask a Talmudic scholar, and you might do that if you run into one on the street, how to pronounce this word. So this is the name given to what has come through now in the world to be designated as divine spark. Now, I'm sure that there might be a Kabbalistic student or a devotee of the Zohar who would stand up right now and protest and say that that is not true, that that is not the case, that Talmudic scholars do not define or do not attribute to the Cliffoth the quality of divinity. And they will say, that's wrong. John Lash is wrong, because actually that word represents or designates demonic beings who have fallen to the lowest level of the Tree of Life, that is to say, the hierarchical scheme of creation. And you will find enormous amount of material out there intended to convince you that the Cliffoth fragmentary entities are not divine and cannot be equated with divine sparks. But I'm here to tell you that all that information is intentionally misleading. When you look at the Zohar and the Kabbalah, you need to distinguish very carefully between what you are told about it by the experts and what the experts among themselves say. And these are not the same. So an expert in the Kabbalah would never claim that the Cliffoths are divine sparks and therefore thereby can be associated with human beings as divine sparks that have fallen into the darkness of matter. They would never say that. But I am telling you that is actually what they mean. That is actually the way they understand it among themselves. But you see, they can't say it in the way that I'm saying it here for a couple of reasons. One is they don't want the world at large to know about their secret doctrines. But also, they are in confusion. They are in cognitive dissonance regarding their own secret doctrines. Because if they were to equate the Cliffoth with human beings, and if they were to attribute divinity to the Cliffoth, then by inference, they would have to attribute some kind of divinity to human beings. And this they do not do, you say. But it's a problem for them, as well as a deception for others, outsiders, those who don't belong to their in-group. Because those who are part of the in-group are actually in deep cognitive dissonance about what they themselves think and believe. And this is a dilemma of that particular religious tradition. Nevertheless, strange as it may seem, you can find today in contemporary material certain scholars from that tradition who do equate the Cliffoth with the term divine spark. For instance, if you go to one of the major platforms of the doctrines of, what is it called? Shabbat Lubavitch on the internet. If you go to their main site, you'll find that one of their big talking points is Tikkun Olam, the correction of the world. And how do they describe the correction of the world, which is the central project of their agenda? They describe it as the rescue or salvation or ascension of the divine sparks who are trapped in matter. So when you come forward to today, there is a specific connotation to that term, and it derives from those sources. It does not derive from Gnostic sources, and as a matter of fact, it is radically opposed to Gnostic sources. You know, a great deal of the Coptic material that you find in the Nag Hammadi writings is based on Greek. And many of the Coptic words are loan words from Greek. And you will find in those texts the Greek word sporo and the Greek word sperma, meaning germ or seed. But you will not find the Greek word for spark in those Gnostic teachings. That word is spita. Now, I may be wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've raked through those Coptic Greek materials with a fine-tooth comb many times, and I have never encountered the word spita. So it doesn't belong either in the ancient Gnostic legacy, nor does it belong to the living Gnosis today. So what I'm saying in summary is that the notion of the restoration of the divine sparks, the presumption that you, your consciousness of being alive, is a divine spark enmeshed in dark matter, is a central doctrine of the Kabbalah and Chabad Lubavitch. And all you have to do to prove that's true, and I'm not making it up, I'm not misrepresenting what they believe, is to go to their site and search for Tikkun Olam, and you find various links. And one of them says, the fallen sparks of Tohu. And the lead line is, quote, the universe began with an explosion, and we are putting back together the fragments. The very core of God's shattered dream, waiting for us to pick up the pieces, end quote. So whenever you hear anyone who presumes to be expounding Gnosticism and is using the term the divine sparks, they're really propagating Talmudic doctrine, which has been carried forward into the Zohar and the Kabbalah. Buyer, beware. So finally, in conclusion, if you don't mind, I'll repeat myself. I've been repeating myself a lot lately, and it's not my style of delivery, but it's possibly what I have to do in order to get out PT so that it's accessible to people. But I have said that those who claim that the Gnostics taught that the material world is a product of an evil being called the Demiurge, and that the consciousness of human animals and even our individual identities, which are a product of our consciousness, a byproduct, are trapped in that dark matrix of matter. And I've pointed out why this is so fundamentally wrong. It says explicitly in the Gnostic cosmology that there is an entity called the Demiurge, that is the Lord Archon, that is the central intelligence of the Archontic Hive. But the Gnostics taught that the demiurge did not literally create the material world in which you exist. He only claimed to do so. He pretended to do so, and he continues to pretend to be the creator of the world, you see. Why don't others who are presenting this other version of Gnosticism, which stands in such strong contrast to mine, why don't they ever mention this factor of pretending, of make-believe, of simulation? The Sanskrit word hal is the signature of the archons, and it means simulation or virtual reality. So wherever you are involved in virtual reality or online adult fantasy games, you're actually putting yourself into the realm of the archons. But the archons are messengers of deceit. They always lie. They pretend to be something that they're not. The Gnostics were viciously attacked and in some cases murdered because they came out openly in conversation with Judeo-Christian ideologues and said, hey, hold on a minute. That entity that you call the Supreme Father God, the off-planet creator of this material world, is actually a demented alien who only pretends to be the creator of this world. How come I'm the only one that's pointing this out? Can you explain that to me? So I want to leave you with that resounding distinction. The demiurge does not create the material world. The material world that you live in, here on Earth, and the entire body of the planet is a transformation of the Aeon Sophia. It is her body, more specifically, her dream body, comparable to the body that you have when you're dreaming. And so the material world of nature is not a trap where you, as a divine spark, have fallen. And you do not need to be delivered from the material world. On the contrary, the path of the Living Gnosis Today and Planetary Tantra takes you into deep immersion with the material world, the world of nature, but as well the world of psyche, because as I've said before, nature and psyche are a unity, and your psychic processes are events in nature as much as a flower blossoming, or a thunderstorm. I think one of the key phrases for me that always brings me back to this wonderful realization comes out of Wilhelm Reich in one of his later books called Cosmic Superimposition, in which he said, quote, sensation is the greatest mystery of natural science, end quote. Now, I could edit right there, and I could add another phrase. Sensation is not only the greatest mystery of natural science, it's also the greatest mystery of mystical science. Sensation is what makes you aware of matter, and matter is a profound mystery. And within the mystery of matter is another mystery, which is the mystery of mass. And that goes to the riddle of inner space, which is the subject of another talk. And I would say that's about enough said for right now.